Of 9 a.m. having arrived, I'm going to call to order the Government Operations Reform Technology and Elections Committee. We are working today off the July 10th worksheet that was developed primarily by Mr. Shepherd. We won't announce the date of our next meeting. We have a couple logistical issues here with some vacations that are coming up. Not the chairs, by the way, but people who are more important than the chair, some of our key staff, so that we'll announce that as soon as we can find out what that will be. With that, I want to have Mr. Shepherd walk us through the July 10th memo, and then we will open it for discussion and or testimony. So, Mr. Shepherd.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. The outline that I'm going to walk through briefly is entitled Floor Procedures, Conference Committees, and End of Sessions. For everybody that was here at the last meeting, you'll remember that you were discussing then possible changes relating to the committee process, and so this picks up with the other parts of the legislative process, the floor and then conference and then end of session issues. As I did with the previous outlines, I started by just outlining what I see as some of the policy trade-offs that are inherent in any of these, and my thought that the legislative rules and procedures can be viewed as a way of choosing among competing goals. Some of the goals, again, the main ones that you tended to focus on last time were just efficiency and ability to get things done quickly versus deliberation and the ability for all members to have as much input as they want into the process, along with the public. Also, as noted previously, as I walk through some of these, you'll note that there's, if you do choose to recommend changes in any of these procedures, there's various ways that this could be done. Some could be done just by house rules, and others would probably be better done by amending the joint rules, and some could be done with just cultural or informal changes. And others, it might be preferable to make changes in rules to accomplish them. As was the case with the committee process, this list certainly is not all-inclusive. I tried to just write down some ideas that had come up either in things that NCSL had presented to you or in ideas that individual members had submitted. And then I've just tried to compile this to give you a framework to discuss these issues. So on page 2 of the outline, I've started by with the major subheading A, talking about floor procedures, and I tried to first of all just cluster together those kind of procedures that deal with consideration of amendments, and the suggestions that I've listed here that have come up in some prior discussions and suggestions. The first group relate to germaneness of amendments, either more clearly defining in rules what it means for an amendment to be germane, or changing the substance of the germaneness standard by making it either more or less restrictive. The next cluster of topics that relate to amendments relate to various restrictions on amendments, things like forbidding amendments that annex other bills, or somehow restricting consideration of amendments or ideas that have been considered and defeated already, either in committee or on the floor. The concept of requiring amendments to be pre-filed or having a process to control what amendments would be offered on the floor, either by rule or just by House custom. Establishing time limits for debates on amendments, on each individual amendment or on all amendments to bills. Again, these things could be done formally by rule, or they could be done simply by custom and discussions among majority and minority leaders. A topic that's been discussed in prior bienniums is revisions in the rule governing the effect of the budget resolution on amendments on the House floor. And finally, something that has been discussed by this committee previously, the notion of limiting delete all or major amendments on the House floor. And again, I just note that a lot of these things, if you decided to recommend them, could be done either formally in a rule or by custom or agreement or just changing the normal practices of the House. The next cluster of ideas relates to consideration of bills on the House floor. And some of the things that have come up in this regard are using a general orders calendar to a larger extent or smaller extent, taking up bills in an order stated on a published agenda, enhancing the ability of individual members to bring up bills for floor consideration, the notion of time limits for debate on each bill, again, either formal or informal. And the last idea under this block of ideas is a period during which the text of Senate amendments to House files would have to be available before the House could vote to concur on the Senate amendments. Under floor procedures, the top of page 3, the last topic is kind of a miscellaneous topic of other issues that have come up related to House floor procedures. The first one is an idea that has been suggested of not allowing waiver of the rule that forbids meeting after midnight. The second one is another scheduling issue, which would be just to consider the scheduling of floor sessions in relation to committee meeting times, which would come earlier or later in the day. A specific member suggestion was providing for the possibility of having floor votes that would specifically address the issue of whether the body believes a bill or an amendment is constitutional or not. The possibility of establishing deadlines for the first or the second house floor action on some or all bills. The possibility of limiting either how often or how long an individual member could speak on each amendment or bill. And finally, one idea that has come up in prior meetings of this committee, developing a custom or a formal mechanism of referring bills back to committee if extensive amendments are needed, and perhaps doing this even after committee deadlines by granting exemptions from deadlines if that's necessary. Mr. Chair, the next major block of topics has to do with conference committees and the end of session generally. Under the topic of conference committees, the first idea listed here would be to adopt a practice that is in place in some other states of allowing bills to be passed between the House and Senate more than once before requiring a conference committee. Restricting the ability of conference committee members, even less than a quorum perhaps, to meet privately. Attempting to schedule conference committees at a time and with enough notice so that there could be more public participation. Changing the standards that are currently both in joint rules and in House and Senate rules for what can be included in a conference report. The notion of requiring conference committees to meet and accept testimony on final conference committee reports. The potential for establishing different requirements for different from the current joint rules for how long conference committee reports have to be available before they can be taken up by the House and the Senate. And finally, the notion of the potential for increasing the use of joint House-Senate committees so that there might be less conference committee action or fewer differences between the bodies, and or establishing joint committees that would have an institutional role in negotiating major items at the end of the session. And that, Mr. Chair, on the last page flows into the last topic, which is just some miscellaneous topics having to do with the end of session. There have been some suggestions that the legislature could consider having a deadline for acting on bills or conference reports that would be a prescribed period in advance of the constitutional deadline for acting on bills. And a variation on this would be a period during which the only possible legislative action would be making technical corrections to legislation that the legislature had already passed. The last two are just kind of soft ideas for consideration. The degree to which major decisions can or should be made by a relatively small leadership group versus being distributed more widely to a number of individual conference committees. And finally, just the notion of having customs or rules that would ensure that staff have adequate time to prepare final drafts of conference reports and other bills at the end of session, and that all the members, the executive branch, and the public have more time to review these documents before they're acted on, either in conference committee or on the floor. So, Mr. Chair, that concludes my outline for your discussion.
Thank you, Mr. Shepherd. Members, it's my intent to have at least two more hearings, and those hearings would be primarily to put a framework around what our recommendations would be for the 2009 session. So once we're done with the discussion of the topics that are before us, then the next hearings would actually be putting together our recommendations for 2009. I did say, and I welcome all of the individuals who have joined us today, that our next hearing, we won't announce the date today. We're going to take a look to make sure that we can have staff at the next hearing because we're going to need them. And we do have some vacation issues coming up. But I'm going to try to maintain our two-week bubble so that we don't meet outside of that, that everyone's still fresh. So with that, any discussion on the memo that Mr. Shepherd just went over today? Or if there's anyone that wishes to come down and testify also. Representative Peterson.
I see that the clerk's office is here, and
yes.
I would guess that they would love to weigh in on this. And maybe having them weigh in before they hear legislators starting to pro or con some of this stuff. It would just be interesting to have them go through the list and just react. Are they willing to do that?
And the chief clerk is here, and he's
shaking his head.
He's more than willing. I think he's more than willing to come down. So if the chief clerk would.
I don't know if it's better to do it early or later, but
early is probably better. Representative Hauser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I could just add one other suggestion, if he is coming forward, you know, one of the things you did early on was learn from other states to determine what works other places, what models are out there, and I'm sure that chief clerks meet at least once a year. And one of the other things we might learn from is just as he reflects on this, if he can suggest to us any discussions that other chief clerks across the country have had. I know we have the finest model here for chief clerk work, but in terms of process, if there's something we could learn from the meetings they might have had.
Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, L. Mathlitz, Chief Clerk of the Hulse. Guess I wasn't prepared to actually comment on this. I was hoping the discussion would take place, and it's really your process. And I influence too much. I'm an old-timer that people around here understand that I have so much respect for the legislative process, and especially the Minnesota Hulse, that I wouldn't be here if I didn't think it was fairly fair and honest. And I've always pushed and always maintained, and my predecessor did, that, you know, free and fair discussion and that type of thing. That's what the process is about. Democracy is one great thing, and we should continue to enhance that process. She made a comment on, we do attend a lot of national meetings, and I don't want to brag or anything, but I'm, like I said, when we go out of town, we're oftentimes sought out to help and to basically talk about parliamentary procedure in our organization. Parliamentary or people in the clerks and secretaries around the country all have different roles, and a lot of them are strictly administrative. Others are more involved in the parliamentary part of it. In about the mid-'80s or so, our organization decided, you know what, we got to start working on training other clerks and secretaries around the country in the parliamentary part of it. Keep in mind, their tenure isn't all that long sometimes, so it's hard to keep that process going. But they established a training program on parliamentary procedure, and we were very involved in that. And because we insisted that our society should be taking more of a role in that than what we were prior to that. And quite frankly, you know, when we visit, we have a very good process, I think, for the elements that we have to deal with. You got to keep in mind that every state is different. We are a swing state for one thing. Like I mean by that, Democrat, Republican, a lot of the states are been Democrat for many, many years or Republican for many, many years. And not only that, is some states are 100-5 or, tremendous majorities. We're very close. And a lot of this activity the last 20 years or so has a lot to do with the fact that, our majority switched and our numbers are close. And it amazes me that we have had a fairly good luck with our procedure, at least, that the process on the floor is in place that has served us very well, I think. The thing that changes in Minnesota, and we've had a tied House, leadership changes, we've had a tri-government, not a lot of states have had to experience those type things. So very trying. I know the tied House was quite an experience for us. It established some things that you're probably talking about today, like we had time clocks back in 1979 that we purchased, because they were afraid that we weren't taking things up in the order in which we received it. So if you introduced the bill, we had to time it. We'd have to bring them to our desk, and we'd have to put a time date up, stamp on it. Amendments came in, we timed them all. That type of thing. So we did that just 1 year and then immediately discarded that. So, I mean, there are things like that that happen and that people remember. So my observation is, it might not sound very efficient sometimes, but I think we have a heck of a process that involves a lot of people. We try to keep them involved. Grant you, we go a little far afield once in a while. And I maintain that sometimes writing and rule, a lot of guidelines and stuff, is just another way for somebody to try to figure out a way to get around it. I spend a lot of time trying to help people, the rule doesn't say that, doesn't say this and that, and I kind of threw in, this is what's going to happen if. That type of thing, because we've kind of gone full circle around here over the years in my tenure, where you can see where it comes back at you. So I don't want to spend a lot of time on this if people have specific answers, but the other thing I want to caution you about is before we start establishing rules based on what other states do, and that's fine, but we're unique in this country, and so is every other state. And you can't just pick and choose things from other states and think that's going to translate into a good process for Minnesota. When you go out and you hear this about, timelines and all this kind of stuff in other states, and people say, well, you don't have any timelines, that type of thing. And I said, well, no. But I said, we do have our problems with it. But I look at the positive side of it. I say we go through the process without timelines. These other states have them, and I don't think they have any better luck than we do. In the long run. So I'm not, you're getting an opinion on how I feel on some of these issues, perhaps, but I think we got to be careful because their sessions aren't as long. Some of them are all year. If we had annual sessions, there's a lot of things we could do. Exchanging messages gets to be a problem for us if we have this midnight deadline on May 19th next year or whatever. Trying to exchange messages back and forth, that creates a problem for us, and getting copies made or make available to members. So those are things you kind of have to keep in mind as we go through this whole process.
Representative Husband has a follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the things that I think we have a concern about in this process is public perception. And that probably weighs as heavily as what we might look for models for change. My understanding is at an earlier meeting, we heard from some of the revisers and research staff about the volume of work they were expected to process, including drafting of amendments. And what I understood is there was a sense that they were saying we can't assure accuracy of our work when that happens, that we can make mistakes. We would like to proofread these several times. And that obviously would be a concern for us, not only from the staff's analysis of that, but how the public might perceive that. And you, as boss of a front desk, I would think would have some sense, too, of understanding the front desk employees and what they might be called upon to do. I think that idea of public perception is not something we should take for granted. If they see us going late into the night, I know what I have heard over and over. Can you still think straight at 2 in the morning or 4 in the morning? I mean, that is the public perception when they think about working through the night or working 2 days in a row. And one of the advantages, I would think, then, of looking broadly what happens across the country, if some of our discussion is perceived to limit debate or be non-democratic, one would have to say, if other states find that workable, are they not equally reflecting a democratic process? So I do hope that we at least pay some attention to what happens in other states. But to specifically the question of workload on the House floor that has to be generated to the minute, and how staff might perceive that.
Mr. Maffley.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I've dealt with this so long that, you know, it just comes, I just expect it, I guess. But anyway, I can't say enough about the staff that work in this process, because it's a machine that's absolutely amazing. I don't know of another state that probably has staff that work together and revises all our joint agencies. House and Senate, we have a wonderful working relationship between the two bodies. In some states, that's their problem. The problem is it doesn't work that well. We have a joint bill drafting department, gross and enrolling department, that people for years came here to try to model. But we've had it for, we don't know anything else. I mean, we've just always had that. Each house in the early 50s did their own engrossing and own enrolling. And I lost the train. Okay.
The issue of heavy workload is posed in a very short time frame and very spur of the moment with not a lot of advance.
Yeah, you know, it presents itself. It weighs on a lot of folks to keep up with that. It's so much. Everybody, even if you watch the front desk, we all have a particular job to do, and I don't have to pay any attention to what they're doing. That's the same way with the workings in other offices around there. They all know what their job is, and when session starts, we're engaged. We're basically engaged. Grant you, there are ups and downs in the timeline. Like for us, the last couple months, when we go 2-3 weeks with 3-4 nights of, you know, 15, 18 hours or something. Yeah, three in a row is hard, almost impossible. But if we have a day in between or something, that gives us a break. I have to agree that it's extending the accuracy eventually here and the ability of staff to handle it. In our office, we've down 2 or 3 staff in the last couple of years trying to do more work. And I think a lot of agencies that's the case. And, you know, technology is wonderful, but in order to keep the public informed, we take that great pride in that. And years ago, you know, the public would get information the next day. Now they get it within an hour after session. All the roll calls, all the amendments, everything offered on the floor now is available. We have, I think, and I don't know others can vouch for this, but I think we have the best, web page and overall overwhelming interaction between the legislative process right here in Minnesota. Won a lot of national awards for our websites and the ability to get copies of things. Other states do some things well, but we do other things well, and for various reasons, because that's our custom and that's the importance we put on it. But, yeah, it'll get, I mean, if it continues like that, but my observation always is we have our up sessions, down sessions. It takes a while to perhaps get into a routine. Introduction of bills were way up in the 70s, and then for years they were at the 2000 level. Now they're back up to 3 and now 4. I'm not saying it's going to stay at 4. My guess is with all this discussion and stuff, people are going to talk, and the numbers may drop. They may even drop 1,000. You never know. And that's basically what's happened over time. It's amazing. And in this state, we have a lot. We don't have term limits in Minnesota, but yet we do have a lot of new members every 2 years. And there is a learning curve there, and we want to engage them all also. So Enough said, I guess, but I think we have one of the best processes in Minnesota is keeping the public informed, and I take that very seriously. And I think all the other people, our information office and everybody else is.
Representative Hausman, in the packet, we have kept a record of the testimony, and I think you're referring to particularly Patrick McCormick did testify, and that's in the packet. He's here today. If you want to ask that question directly to him, he might have the best quantitative answer. In fact, I'm looking at it. It's the second to the last page of his testimony under efficiency and time compression, where he used House File 1812 as an example and the number of amendments, and then the ability of value added. What happens when you're up to 247 amendments, when he alone was drafting over 30 amendments in a three-hour period, and how do you get value added for that? That's probably not a question that the chief clerk can answer, but it is a question that the revisor's office and House Research have already answered for us, and it's in the packet. If you want to have Mr. McCormick come down and respond to that.
My understanding was that was on the record at a previous meeting.
It was, and it's in the packet also. Yeah. So. I've got a list. Is it to this point?
To that point, I mean, we talk a lot about the amendments to that one bill, the House File 1812.
Right.
And but we don't often talk a lot about the bill itself. That I think is part of the creation of the amendments was the way the bill was packaged together in the first place. So, you know, when we talk about the amendments, I hope that we'll, you know, kind of consider the front end of that process, which, Mr. Chairman, I know you have mentioned on the record before, and I just thought that I'd throw that back since we're talking about the amendments themselves.
Representative Broad, at the hearings, and we haven't had all of the members at every hearing, but we have had a discussion of this at some length about why 1812 was put together the way it was, and then why it was taken apart. Both were probably poor examples of legislation, and the results were, shall we say, controversial. That might be the best word I can use right now. So, but that's an ongoing discussion, and that's one of our problems. There is no quick fix here, and fixing one thing will probably lead to problems in other areas if we're not careful. So, but keep reminding us of that. 1812 is the most egregious recent example, but we could go back and have others. On the list I have, Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Matthewitz, one of the suggestions in our packet here that has been discussed is requiring amendments to be pre-filed. I'm not sure that a lot of discussion has gone into the mechanics of how that would be done. I would imagine that this would place a certain burden on your office, being that you would be a trusted office to deal with this appropriately. What kind of problems do you foresee with such a requirement, particularly in terms of the logistics and the workload for your office?
Mr. Matt.
Mr. Chair and members, Representative Morgan, my first comment would be we love pre-filed amendments. And that's just because that makes our job easier. We'd have them all. You know, it makes sense. We can have them in this database and that type of thing. However, when we went to all this electronics over the years, it was my goal and former chief clerk that we not have to make any rule changes in order to provide amendments electronically. We think we've pretty much mastered that, whereby we can give you the amendment, even though you bring them up on the fly. And we didn't want to have to go to a rules committee and say we have to change our procedure because of technology. And we worked very hard to do that, and that has caused some problems for like the revisor's office when they are around the chamber now typing amendments and House research people. I can't really speak for them, but I know it puts a strain on them. But if we had pre-filed amendments, we know which ones you're going to take. My caution with pre-filed amendments is, how are you going to handle amendments to amendments, and what's the waiver going to be, and all those types of things. I guess we were real proud that we were able to continue the process, and as the debate takes place, oftentimes there are a lot of changes, some changes that need to be made. You really got to allow for that to happen, I think, if we're going to continue to debate amendments on the floor like we do presently. That would be my main concern. The other thing is everything would have to be in a database somewhere, so that and that we can handle them on the pre-filed. And I guess the procedure for handling amendments to amendments would probably be the same free-for-all that we have right now. Unless you provide it means there. So,
Mr. Mathews, we took significant testimony from the Government Relations Council on this issue of amendments. In fact, almost 2 hours of testimony at two meetings. Their concern, and it's a concern of several of the members also, is that a significant number of these amendments have never been heard in committee, never introduced as a bill. I'm talking about amendments that just appear on the floor, and we really don't know what they do. And when you're in the hundreds of amendments on a bill, and 1812 may be the most recent example, but certainly how many bills would come to the floor and there are 60 or 70 amendments drafted to them. So it is a concern that these amendments, the first look we get is literally when they're passed out. And we have no comprehension of the impact of the amendment quite often, and no public input on the amendment. I'm underscoring the fact that if I agree with you, I like the fact that if they were posted 24 hours in advance, at least someone would have the ability, the public would have the ability to take a look at them. And it might change the number of amendments that went to an amendment if we understood what the amendment did. So I agree with you that I would like to see them posted too. Representative, yes, Mr. Mathis.
I think administratively what Representative Morgan was asking was the workload on us, and I think it seems like we can handle it, and I think that would be something that would be certainly manageable.
I have one other question for you. When you say that the you didn't want to change the rules with the new technology, but the technology has taken off in a way that we wouldn't have envisioned 10 years ago, my observation would be our rules are somewhat antiquated, given the technology that we now have. The technology can help us, certainly, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. The public can get almost anything that's filed. But the issue is, it's filed. It's posted. What happens is the things that aren't filed or posted, and the speed with which we can create these amendments, and even bills, frankly. My observation would be that our rules no longer reflect 21st century technology, and that the technology is running much faster than we are, and we're not catching up. That's my observation. But with Representative Morgan, you have another question? Representative Peterson.
I'm going to pass now.
Representative Graham.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have 4 points, I guess, that I want to make. I really like this process with these ideas, and then we can discuss them, and I don't really have anything for Mr. Mathewich unless he cares to comment. But number one, I really feel strongly that on page 2, under consideration of bills, letter B, that we take up bills in the order stated on a published agenda. It was something new that we stopped doing this under Speaker Swigum, and before that we had always taken them up in order. And now the Democrats have continued on with that power of the majority to keep the minority off balance. But I would submit that it also is a very big disservice to the public, because they're wanting to see what we're going to do. And if we hop all around and don't take things up in order, I think it really makes it hard for anybody, whether it's the news media that's trying to inform the public, the lobbyists who have the public to answer to, or just playing the public out there, if we just, go willy-nilly through our scheduled agenda. So I would hope we would go back to our long-standing practice of taking bills up in order. It's very recent that we stopped doing that, and we should stop doing it the way we have done it recently. Number two, even though I would like time limits, I like people that go to my committee know I like a snappy meeting. I'm leery of artificial time limits for, even though we all have certain members we don't want to hear talking anymore. I think Mr. Mathewich has kind of hit the nail on the head when, as soon as we have any kind of rules about time limits, we just know that some really smart
legislators are going to figure out how to get around those rules. And so I would rather that we would just look to our caucuses and our leaders and our, trying to have a message on the floor. And as soon as you have all those amendments, the free-for-all, Representative Houston and I were liking that phrase because that's how we think of it, too, then I think we could do a better job of policing ourselves. But to try to have rules that some members would get around anyway, I'm leery of. But the general idea I'm very supportive of. Number three, I remember when former Representative McElroy worked on the idea of under B, conference committees, end of session, then 1A. I liked it then, and I still like it now, allowing bills to be passed between the House and the Senate more than once before requiring a conference committee or maybe even needing a conference committee. Regardless of whether other states do it, but that's even if the fact that it's working in other states is a recommendation for it. But I like the idea, anyway, even if we weren't copying, the idea that it would be a public process where you're working together, trying to work it out, kind of like having joint Senate-House committees. Those two together, I think, working with the other body and doing it publicly would be a great improvement. And then lastly, on the last page, end of session number 2, C, I really like, it doesn't say what to do about it, but consider the degree to which major decisions at the end of session can or should be made by leadership, the governor and the two leaders of the Senate and the House. To me, that was just the worst thing of all, to close out the public, close out the press, close out 99% of the legislators, and then just come up with a product that was, slapped on the table. I think that is not democracy, and we should, if we do nothing else in this committee, make a strong recommendation that we never want to see that again. 3 weeks of just a few making all the shots. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And first of all, Representative Greiling, your final point, I'm in 100% agreement with you on that. You're absolutely right. Mm-hmm. However, let me ask just have a conversation about this under page 2. Excuse me. Where is the timeline? The guidance on establishing, there you go, page 2, 2D, establishing time limits for debate. And you stated your opposition to having, and if I paraphrase this incorrectly, let me know, but basically any limit on time debate on the House floor. Yet, in the committee process, we have limits on debate. The committee chair, whether people want to seek recognition or not, we have a limit. At some point, the chair just drops the gavel and says, we're going to hear one more person and then we're going to vote. And explain to me why the limits in committee are fair, but the limit on the House floor would be wrong.
Representative Grant.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Garofalo, I guess I would clarify that I wouldn't be so opposed to time limits as leery that they would work. If you, being a brilliant legislator, could come up with some time limits that work, I'd be the first to support them. I think we shouldn't spend our time making time limit rules because I don't think they would work. If you could show me that they did and that would, but otherwise I think we could debate and argue about time limits and waste time doing that. Mm-hmm. I think if we had strong leadership, strong caucuses, and we peer frowned on each other, if it worked, that the culture here was, those legislators who talk and talk and talk are not the respected ones. But instead, oftentimes, we encourage people to talk. We say, here, you talk as long as you can because there's an amendment being drafted. And it's really the amendment rule, not the talking. That legislator didn't want to go on and on, but they were handed the microphone to take up time while the amendment was being drafted. Or we want the leaders to, do a lot of talking. But more often than not, it seems to be renegade legislators who people just cannot control. And they go on, and even the members of their own caucus, or even if they have no caucus, we all just groan when they stand up. And You know, maybe, so I'm just wondering if we have rules about time limits, if they would really work.
Representative Greiling, we took testimony from NCSL, and they gave us, and again, we're looking at other states, and that's what we started to do, but there were states that had specific time limits on major omnibus bills. It would be an hour or 2 hours. It would be divided equally between the majority and the minority, and you had X amount of time. When the time was up, you went to a vote. That was it. So it was a rather simple procedure. The chief clerk is here, and we do have the revisor's office and House research. The other problem is this. If you have no time limit, we're more than likely to go past midnight, the 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, and staff will be here hours after that. And again, if we're looking at a value-added product or a product that anyone understands, when you're pushing those types of hours, what are you accomplishing? And then the opposite side is, what was done in committee? What was actually accomplished in committee if we're spending that amount of time on the House floor reconstructing or destructing what was done in committee? Representative Brown.
Mr. Chair, I like the idea. I support the one about not going till midnight. I always raise a heavy hand when I support my caucus when they want to go past midnight. If we had a rule to say we wouldn't go past midnight, I would like that better. Having a time limit for the general bill, I think, is much more workable than a timeline for an individual member, because I think if you had individual members taking up the whole time for that caucus's bill and others wanted to talk, then there would be more self-policing, because others would want to talk, and the one who went on would soon learn that they maybe had trouble getting their own bills heard or something because other people were tired of them. Right now, there isn't any consequence for that. So, but individual members not being able to talk, I guess that one is the one that I'm very leery of it working, or even wondering if it's quite right. But to have some kind of self-policing of the time process, I'm very open to that.
Representative Ruffler, you have another question?
Mr. Chairman, just maybe trying to come full circle and tie the two issues I referenced earlier, is that if the leadership of the caucuses has the ability and the authority to write the bill in the governor's office, it would seem to me that the leadership would have the authority to go out and spend their time and energy negotiating a time limit on these matters. And in the absence of an agreement between the leadership on a time, whatever that time limit is, there would be no limit. But again, to balance the rights of the minority to be heard, but at the same time, to balance the rights of to not have a minority of the minority monopolize the time debate, it would seem that would be a reasonable option.
Well, Representative Graff, you make a good point. And the other point is, in a legislature that is limited, we are a part-time legislature. We have a constitutional deadline. Representative Hausman is here. I think in 2007, she might have preferred that there would have been a time limit and a certain bill would have been allowed to have come up on the floor when we did run out of time, because there was no limit on people talking. And that, of course, was the capital investment bill for 2007. And your point, Representative Graffel, is an excellent one. We can negotiate almost anything here, and we should be able to negotiate this and allow time for everyone, perhaps, to speak. Remember, in our rules, it does say you're not supposed to speak twice on any issue until every other member who wishes to speak has spoken. It's not enforced, but it's there. And that's the other point. Once we do these, we should enforce them. And that means from day one, not just at the end of session when we invoke rules that I would prefer we not invoke at the end of session. Representative Graffler, you have another point? No. Representative Simon?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Mathewitz, I have a question similar to Representative Morgan's about the effect on your staff of one of the particular proposals, and it's one we've just discussed, time limits. If we were to adopt something similar to the U.S. House of Representatives, at least as I understand it, and if, at least on major bills, the Rules Committee would actually function as a true Rules Committee and set a rule on debate for each individual bill. That would be debated in the Rules Committee, or it could be done by edict, I guess, by the Speaker. I guess it doesn't matter so much. But I guess the question I have for you is, if we were to have, say, a global time limit, and each side had, I don't know, 3 hours on a particular omnibus bill, let's say, or 2 hours, whatever it was, what effect would that have on your staff? Is that doable? Is that something you can envision? Would it require expanding the staff? how would that work? And let me just add just one detail to that. If, like the U.S. House, we would also do it where members could yield time, where you'd have a floor leader on a particular bill who was put in charge of that bill, and he or she would decide how much time, if a member wanted to speak, they would get. That member might say, you know, I'm going to yield 4 minutes of our 2 hours, or 5 minutes, or 10 minutes, or 1 minute. Those kind of timing considerations, would that be something that your staff could handle? I'm sure they could handle it, but I mean, what effect would that have?
Mr. Mann.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Simon. Time limits on bills was a new concept in 99. I think it was 99. We, at that point, our first assistant, Pat Murphy, will keep a log as we go, and every time somebody gets up and speaks, he writes in the time now. Since that rule has been removed, we still do it. And we still keep track, and we know at when so-and-so went on and how long we were on an amendment, perhaps, I think, and how long we've debated a bill. So I don't think that is going to present a problem. However, yielding time, those types of things, is a major, I would think, a major record keeping. I mean, somebody's got to subtract and add and, you know, keep a log and all kinds of things. I would think that would be, I don't know how they do it in Congress. I find it interesting how they do it, but they're a whole different institution than we are. So the way we handle it now, it's workable, I guess. But it's one of those things that, you know, was put in place, and now 4 years later it was taken away, and I'm really not privy to the logic behind that. However, I know there was a lot of anxiety when that rule was put in and then never used, and basically decided, well, why do we have it type of a thing. And I think Representative Garofalo raised a good point. Sometimes I think that if the majority and minority got together before we went to the floor someday and say we're going to spend 2 hours on our caucus, takes 2 hours, your caucus and have 1 hour or an amendment or whatever, sometimes I wonder, or so much time for this bill today. And maybe, you know, that's one of the ways that you know, you can probably work some of this out. I know that doesn't always work, but you know, those are certainly options. I'm not opposed to putting in a time limit. Not at all. But I certainly don't encourage it. I mean, proposing it from my perspective, I'm not opposed to it, but I'm not proposing it.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Simon. I'm sorry, is that
Rich Sengra? Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair, I apologize for stepping in and asking, or making this point a second time to my friend and colleague, but I want to make sure there's an important distinction between what I was mentioning and my good friend from St. Louis Park was mentioning. There's a big difference between a limit and time debate with the consent of the minority and the majority imposing a time limit on the debate. To me, I'm willing to open that door a crack and have that discussion, but the idea of the federal level, where the majority simply imposes a time limit, that is different. I want to make sure we understand that there is a big distinction and a big difference between those two proposals.
And Representative Garofalo, when we're done, however we're going to make these recommendations, I would hope that at least we could come to some consensus on that, that there would be a method that we could agree to that would allow for both to occur. Representative Hausman.
Without a time limit, you do, in effect, give more power to the person who talks more. Because, in effect, what happens on the floor is everybody else who is sick of it and wants to just get to a vote starts telling all of the colleagues around them, don't talk. I mean, you start to stand up and you get, you know, glares from other people saying we've got to end this. I mean, in effect, that peer pressure goes not to the person dominating the discussion, but all of the other people who then say, we've just got to not say anything more because we've got to get to a vote. And so a lack of time limit, in a sense, gives more power in the legislative process to the one person who dominates.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple other quick points. I'll try to get them all out now. First, I think one thing that I think we all agree on, but as to different areas, is the need for notice. You know, let me just put it in partisan terms right now. I mean, because each party seems to be focusing on a different area. At the end of the 2007 session, I know there was a lot of frustration on the Republican side about the very last-minute construction and unrolling or unveiling of conference reports, and I've really kind of come around on that. At first, when I, you know, on that last tumultuous day of session, I thought, you know, what's the big deal? We always roll out things at the last minute, but I've really come around on that, and I've come to understand and sympathize with a lot of Republican members and what they were saying on that last day of session, which is, you know, we got to look at this bill. It's 1,000 pages long, and it was, I think, easier for us on the majority side to kind of shrug our shoulders because the people doing the crafting and the unrolling were people who we trusted and agreed with on issues. But I think notice as to those big bills, I think that's a really good point, and I've really changed my position on that, at least as that incident. But the same holds true if you turn the tables on amendments. And I think there's a feeling of ambush on the majority side as to a lot of the minority, you know, amendments that come in at the last minute. And a lot of people from other states can't believe that we don't have a notice rule for floor amendments. So I think one big thing that I think we can all agree on, although we may emphasize different points in the process, is the need for more notice, whether it's a 12-hour rule or 24-hour rule with respect to conference committee reports or growing that to 48 hours and then with amendments having 24 hours. So I think that's one thing. The second thing, I think, is some reasonable time limitation on floor debate. And as Representative Garofalo said, one that enjoys some buy-in, too, from both sides of the aisle. And you know, Representative Broad brought up 1812, and others have as well, what about a giant, you know, clunky monster that was in many ways. But I think, you know, one of the reasons it was, and one of the reasons the decision was made to do an omnibus bill, essentially, as it's been called and criticized, is because there's no discipline on the floor. And the thought going into it, I don't think I'm revealing any big partisan secret here, the thought was, look, do you want 1-4 in the morning night, or do you want 7 or 8? And the decision was made, look, we can do it the easy way or the hard way, you know, and we'll get criticized for doing the omnibus, and it was ugly, and it was probably unprecedented. But because there is no discipline in terms of time limit on the floor, the thought...
And it's inevitable that someone else in the body may have some insights. And when that occurs, if we have limits on time, we are truly violating the basis for free speech. That's why I see this as very problematic. Now, to that point, I know I'm a subject in a lot of people's minds on this matter. And I'll just state for the record, I cannot remember one single email, one single phone call, a complaint about the substance of what I raised on the floor. To the contrary, even recently, I went to an orientation for a new medical clinic that's a little more holistic. And I found it interesting. We all went around the room, shared my name, and the person sitting next to me, when a quiet moment arose, looked at me and said, "Are you Mark Olson, St. Paul?" And I said, "Well, yeah, if you mean from the legislature." He said, "I love listening to you. It's incredible. It's great. I get that stuff all the time. I'm not trying to pat myself on the back. I don't like speaking on the floor. It used to just be the hardest thing in the world for me. I came from a very different background. I have developed the motivation to speak on the floor for one reason. The reason I believe we have the right of free speech. It has to do with the issue. It has to do with the cause. It has to do with why we're here. It has nothing to do with taking the time. Take House File 1812. In anticipation of that, and Representative Poppy, I commend you for establishing for the record that you do have the courage, like others that I've not been aware of, to stand up against your own speaker. I don't boast about it. I've challenged the ruling of my speaker a number of times. In fact, Representative Kelleher, or Speaker Kelleher, was very kind and very, very encouraging to me when I expressed to her, "Now, you know that I've done this with my own speaker. This has nothing against you." And she said, "I know that." And I found her very encouraging with the results of what happened. But could we anticipate that? I found 21 provisions in Mason's manual that we violated with 1812. In principle. Not in custom and usage, but in principle. And we could go into that, but I won't right now, for time's sake. But we need to have a culture that fosters the freedom to go against our own. Because that's the problem here. If Representative Hausman is correct that the person who's doing all the speaking has all the power, well, maybe that is true. But is there any other way to offset the power of the majority that controls which provisions can come up on the floor? Which amendments can come up on the floor by the rulings that are inconsistent with what's allowed in committee? I don't know any other way. That might be why we have to ask the questions. That might be why we have to introduce the amendments. Where do the delete all amendments come from? I hear complaints from the majority mostly about the delete all amendments, but from both sides of the aisle. But have we asked where they come from? From my experience, delete all amendments come from a committee that's not appointed to represent the body, but appointed for an agenda. And you get the bill through committee and suddenly face the body and discover the bill is so controversial, you have to rewrite it. And that isn't often discovered until you get to the caucus. And discover you don't even have your own members able to support your own bill. I've witnessed it in the Republican caucus. I can't say for a fact that it goes on in the Democrat caucus, but I suspect that it goes on everywhere. When you get it through a committee that does not represent the body in principle, on issue, on values, and on ideas, you turn around, you face the body, and suddenly discover you have to rewrite the bill before it comes up on the floor. That is the most common occurrence for delete all amendments from my experience. And it happens, but will happen less if we have bipartisan appointments of committees, true bipartisan appointments of committees, and not such a significantly out of balance majority-minority environment. So, I appreciate the time to share those concerns, and I'd value any comments in response. Thank you.
I'm working off a list. Representative Mason is next.
This goes back to the time, and I know I'm not the most articulate person. There's probably many people like me. But when I was sitting on the floor, there were so many times I wish we did have time frames. And in thinking it over now, and I don't want to handicap free speech, and certainly we all, as you said, we all have our election certificates. But what I kept hearing again and again were people that were bringing up the same amendments again and again. It didn't make any difference what the bill was. They'd bring up the amendment. That, to me, is being incredibly inconsiderate of the body. It has to do with relevancy. It has to do with repetition. And I don't know how we go about actually addressing that particular issue. And then the omnibus bill, I guess, basically the post-omnibus bill.
You brought up 2 points. They're both good. Representative Olson.
To that point, that's a very good point. And we do have a rule that prohibits the same provision from coming before the body. Now, with regard to some amendments, they're written slightly different. If we tweak that rule a little bit, maybe there'd be a way to address some of what you're describing. Because I agree, when they're very similar amendments, almost the same, I think it is a misuse of time.
Representative Kahn is next on the list. All right. Representative Broad.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't want to take time right now, but what I wanted to explain what I'm going to hand out to the body or to the committee, just from the revisor's office, and I know the House Research and others will have some information and statistics as well, but Mr. Mathewitz had indicated, you know, there's a rise and fall, there's a natural ebb and flow to amendments, and I think this will be a visual description of amendments and what has occurred with amendments. From 1995, there was 1,462 amendments, and we're sitting at 1,461 from the revisor's office, and this will just kind of give a description of where we've come, where we were, and that ebb and flow, which is appear appears to be natural. And my only caution is if we just look at today and what's occurring today, I don't want us to solve the wrong problem and to solve the symptom and not dig down, which I believe, Mr. Chairman, you're digging down, but I want everybody to have this information.
Representative Brown, I think we may have it. That information was provided to us by the reviser in their presentation before the committee. But you can,
Chairman,
by all means, pass
it off,
but I think we've already got it. Representative Nelson, to this point?
No.
Representative Stein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to come back to something that Representative Garoppolo said at the beginning, but I think it bears repeating now after this discussion. He was uncharacteristically wise. I'm kidding. Kidding, of course. He was wise as always when he said that, you know, we have to keep this in perspective. We have time limits all the time around here. In committee hearings, we have a time limit on the session. We can only go 120 legislative days. So I think we just have to step back. And when we talk about time limits, they're not unusual. And I think they're practical and they're necessary, as evidenced by how we use them at almost every other step in the process. So I think we have to be careful about emphasizing too much what happens on the floor. I think what I and other members are talking about is some reasonable, perhaps generous or overly generous time limit, but a limit nonetheless. And that would force another thing, which I've heard mentioned here in other contexts as a familiar buzzword, which is discipline. And the fact that it's all about choices and it's all about priorities. And if you had a time limit of 3 or even 4 hours or 5 hours or 6 hours on an omnibus bill, a particular side would say, you know what, we do have 60 ideas for amendments. And we are mad about being squeezed out of the committee process. And we are frustrated that not one of our amendments in the committee got onto the bill. We just didn't have the votes or whatever the reason. But we can't do all these 60. And as Representative Poppy said, in the sort of no parent mode, get in the mood and or actually adopt the process of saying, you know, we can't choose 60 amendments. We just can't do it. That's undisciplined. But we can do a dozen, or we can do 20 if we keep the debate short. But we can't do 60. And I think that's fair. It's consistent with the culture that we have around here for every other step of the process. And I just want to make sure for the record that everyone understands, although I can't speak for anyone else, my impression is that others agree with me that the kind of time limitations we'd be talking about would be very generous ones, hopefully fair ones with buy-in from both sides. But I want to be careful about the idea that's been expressed, which I just respectfully disagree with, that having any time limit whatsoever, either on the length of a bill or on the length of a speech, is somehow muzzling someone. I don't think that's the case. I think the fact that we have the possibility, at least, that any bill we bring it up here could go 100 hours. It could go 200 hours. There is absolutely no limitation other than calling the previous question right now. Any speaker could filibuster any time he or she gets up. It could happen. Now, fortunately, it hasn't happened, but there's nothing to prevent in the rules other than calling the question. And I think we have to be careful about equating reasonable time limits with muzzling. I just don't think that's the case, particularly as Representative Garoppolo reminded us in the beginning, in light of the fact that we have time limitations all the time throughout all the other steps of the process.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've been sitting here listening. I've been to missed a couple of these meetings, but I've been, I think, to most of them. And in the discussion that was going on today, I have to say, early discussion with Representative Broad, I agreed with her on a lot of the things she said. I think we need to look at the history of what's going on here. I think we need to look at what the real disease is, and not just treat the symptoms. Because, you know, it's otherwise we could end up having a problem worse than what we started out in the first place. As Representative Kahn pointed out earlier, when reasoning for why they switched from the general orders to the system we have now. We need to look back and see why we did things and look back at why things are the way they are now. It's easy to look at them through today's lens and what we know today and not look back, well, decisions were made 20 years ago and what was happening then, and not realize a lot has changed since then. And I don't think that what's going on the last couple of sessions has to do as much with what the rules are as the individuals involved and some of them finding ways to twist and bend the rules to muck up the process or to get their point across And I don't think either side, when they've been in the minority, because I've been in both the minority and in the majority, both sides have done it and somewhat in that way and used the rules to get their message out. The complaint that I've heard come out of a couple people that the minorities, none of their amendments got adopted in committee, that also happened when the other side was in the minority, and we put amendments on and none of them would get heard in committee, and so we would bring them up on the floor for the same reason, to get our point across. So that hasn't changed from whether who's in the majority or not. I think it all goes down to fairness. We need to be fair with each other, have respect of each other's time, and respect of the process. And I think some of that is broken down in the last couple of years, is respect of the process and just trying to use the ability to speak as a bully, being a bully or bully pulpit, or being a bully to get their own view, almost to the point of taking the mode of the parents' mode of a two-year-old having a temper tantrum. And so at some point, I mean, we have to get our work done here. But I'm cautious, and I say we need to be cautious as we head forward of putting any limits on or putting limits on, because at some point we may want to, on the other side, be use those same rules today for legitimate purposes. So I guess I'm the underlying thing here. I think we need to be cautious as we head forward, because it's we may not be as smart as we think we are, and other people in the past may set this system up, may have the have had it right.
Representative Kim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I apologize for missing the earlier part of today's discussion, but I'm reminded of sort of this give and take about rules versus custom. I've been learning how to fly fish the last several years, and there's often a trout you can see rising on a stream in Representative Poppy's district or down in your district, Mr. Chair, and there's just, you think you can get it, and you think you can get at it, but even somebody who's been casting for 40 years can't quite get in there without mucking up a line. And my initial mentor always said, discretion is the better part of valor. And I think a lot of what's lacking is kind of self-discipline in addition to leadership and discipline on all sides. I know that, you know, that I've been as guilty of violating that discretion as others. Maybe there are a few standouts, Representative Hausman, violators of that rule. But I think that some of it is that a return to the sort of self-discipline and civility of the deliberative body. But at the same time, I think we do need to have some confines that are in rules, not in self-custom. I think a balance of those is going to be needed to provide a little bit more stronger framework. And so I would urge us to think about what are the limited rules, recognizing Representative Nelson's caution about going too far with them and boxing ourselves in. But if we're getting an amendment where an age limit is 15 years old, and then the next amendment is 14 years old, and then the next amendment is 13 years old, maybe as a body we need to ask the clerk whether, and or maybe as a body decide that we want to interpret that those are the same amendments, seeing a pattern, or we want to deal with setting up a framework where we can, if folks are not providing that kind of discipline on their own, that the body itself decides that we have business that is of higher priority than free speech that has been used and recognized and exercised, but at some point it cannot be unlimited. And I will advocate, as long as I'm here with Representative Olson, as long as he's here and as long as anyone else is, for the rights of the minority to be heard, but also for the rights of the people's business to proceed without, once the minority is heard, without dilatory fashion. And I've actually been spending quite a bit of time, and you and I, Mr. Mathewitz, have talked a little bit already about the use of motions in dilatory fashions under Masons. I think we need to take a very good look at that specific rule, and I'll look it up and we'll get the rule number. But, Mr. Chair, to Representative Olson's statement on the delete everything amendments on the House floor, not only are we a three-stool government with judiciary and executive, but we're a three-school government with the House, the Senate, and the governor's office. And I brought a DE amendment to my design build reform bill that we passed and the Senate didn't take up, but we took it up the second to last day of session. I brought a DE amendment because the governor's office refused to participate in the discussions for the last 3 weeks of session. And so it is not just the House or the Senate, it is not just the committee process, mm-hmm. that it is also the governor's office and the governor himself that bears some responsibility in this process. And we need to continue to work together to find, in good faith, and recognizing that we do, this is a political place, but at some time, discretion is the better part of valor, and you can't always be making political points, that we do have to serve the greater good of the state and do good policy work. And so I just want to add that, having experienced it, it is incredibly frustrating when the very folks who are supposed to supply us with information that will have to administer laws don't chime in on purpose to, in a dilatory fashion, to delay and obstruct. So I guess I'm urging a balance as we move forward with adopting rules, but not too many.
Representative Moore.
Mr. Chair, I would like to move the minutes from the previous two meetings, Friday, June 13, and Monday, June 23.
Any discussion? Hearing no discussion, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Members, before we adjourn today, Representative Hauser.
Representative Poppe brought up something that I realized I have not any background. She talked about the role of discipline of, that the leader exerts. What is available to the leader to apply? Are there tools? She suggested, kind of rhetorically, saying no. What might be available that we haven't been using that would be available to a leader? It's just for a future meeting, if there's information about that.
Reb Sam Hausman, I think what we'll do is put that on the agenda for the next meeting, and then the next item on the agenda is the format that you wish to present to the body for suggestions for 2009. I want to make sure I'm clear here. These are suggestions. We're not doing the rules. We may do them in the format of the rules, and we may do them in such a way that we have incorporated things that maybe not all of us agree to, but these are suggestions. Whatever group is in charge of this body in 2009 will do what it will do. But for the first time since I've been here, there will be at least some suggestions for change. So I would hope that everyone will, at the next meeting, be aware that that's what we'll be working at and the format that we want to make those suggestions in. Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To that point, whenever I've heard you talk about this, it's been maybe in the form of rules. If we could know that ahead of time.
Representative Olson, I've had several members come to me and say that they would prefer that what we would literally do is just rewrite the rules and make suggestions for the joint rules. We can do that in a simple format of underline and strikeout the same way we would deal with legislation, but I want to make it clear this is not a bill. We would then incorporate whatever you wish to incorporate, and then we would have a document that would move forward. That would be my preference, frankly. But we've had an open process here. I think that's the most logical way of doing it. I'm open to suggestions. Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I concur with that and hope that that is the process that you choose.
Representative Olson, I would hope we would come to that conclusion, too. Both you and Representative Simon have made comments about Masons, that perhaps parts of Masons should be officially incorporated into the rules. It would be much clearer to see them, perhaps, in that type of a format than simply saying it's from Masons, whatever section or chapter. Representative Kahn.
And I can't find it in the rules, and I don't know if it's, and I remember, and this is, maybe the Chief Clerk can help, the idea of the precedence of how we decide things. You know, start out first the Constitution, the statutes, the House rules, et cetera. And at some point...
Mr. Mathewitz,
okay.
Mr. Mathewitz, I believe I've seen this, because it's been in front of me on the Speaker's desk.
Right.
And if Mr. Mathewitz wants to provide that at the next meeting, we'll have that for you.
But one of the problem with that was that I, sometimes I believe it was when Jennings was speaker, we displaced, Masons used to take precedence over customs and usage. And we displaced Masons, we put customs and usage ahead of Masons, which I always thought was a really bad idea because it meant any previous, you always had the ability to find some stupid ruling by any speaker that could then be used as a custom and usage. And I do remember circumstances under which things were carefully orchestrated to use Masons because we didn't have it in the rules. But
then I think that's a discussion
that
issue
for... I would like
Let's put that on the agenda for the next meeting.
But it's
meeting.
Not anywhere in the rules. It's just this little...
Let's have that on the agenda for those. Representative Peterson.
Mr. Chairman, one area that we didn't talk about today was this area of conference committees. And the old adage that don't worry about the bill, let's just get the conference and we'll fix it. Maybe at the next meeting, we ought to just take a moment and just see if anybody has anything they want to talk about in conference committees, rather than trying to do it today.
There's been a great deal of concern with the Government Relations Council on conference committees, or the lack of them. Frankly, I think we have two problems there. The fact that they melted down in 07 and that they were sporadic in 08. So we'll put that on the agenda, too, for clarification, because this is a point that Representative Kahn had made earlier. When the conference committees were the format, you even had governors going to conference committees and saying, I want something put in. And if it wasn't the governor himself, it was representatives of the governor's office coming to the conference committee and saying, this is what we want to have put in. So there was public input into what was going on. If there are no conference committees, that cannot occur. And then we don't have, I think the point was made by Representative Hausman and Representative Greiling, we don't have the cross-section of expertise either, saying that if there is a flaw in the tax bill, then it should have been corrected in the tax conference committee and not slipped in with three people in the governor's office with none of them knowing what that sentence meant. Mm-hmm. And that sentence, this session, was a doozy. So we'll put that on the agenda, too. So if everyone's agreeable, we'll do a format of a rewrite of the rules with the discussion of the items that have been brought up by members today. That'll be our next meeting. We'll have a decision on a date, by the way, tomorrow. Representative Hausman.
And to that issue of the conference meeting, that is where we come into this conflict of the different culture in the House and the Senate. And, of course, my bias in the House, what I've always perceived is in the Senate, there is a very strong culture that whatever the chair does, the whole body is going to approve. I mean, that there doesn't need to be that buy-in. Whereas in the House, I would know that I wouldn't assume that even my own caucus would support what I brought back if I was disrespectful to where some people felt we ought to be going. And so at a certain point, that issue of the different culture in the House and the Senate is going to have to sort of get into the mix of the conversation here, and I don't know if at that point there might be a role in inviting someone like Representative Retz into a joint conversation.
Representative Hausman, we're actually considering that. That's been a discussion that I have yet to have with Senator Retz, and we don't have feedback from Senator Pogemiller yet either, which will be most interesting to see what he wants to say about this discussion. But the conference committees are a big issue. We had a small conference committee with Representative Broad on an election bill this past session because she had raised a concern. But we had an official conference committee. It was held. It was recorded. And actually, her point was a good one. It went out, and it was incorporated into the conference committee with public discussion. I would have hoped we would have had a conference committee on all of the elements that were in 1812. It would have helped. And you, as capital investment chair, know the value of a conference committee on a bill such as capital investment.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Peterson.
And I was on a conference committee, to your point, where the chairwoman from the Senate was not about to hear an amendment that was being offered by a representative from the House. And that representative was sitting here and the chair was sitting there. I just backed up because there was so much electricity going between those two ladies that I didn't want to be in the line of fire. But the chair was not about to let the House member have
anything to say about the issue and just hammered it down.
And remember, conference committees are unique because we need an equal number of votes from both sides mm-hmm. to prevail. So if it's five, we need 3 and 3, at least under current rules, we do. So we have to educate our own members that if you want that incorporated, you need it 2 or 3 from the other side, depending on the size of the conference committee. So, but you're right, that was a little bit of a spark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I brought a handout today I didn't feel was fitting for today, but I think it would be for the next meeting, if I may. It has to do with constitutionality rulings on the floor.
We actually touched on that today. I don't know if you were here, but we did touch on it.
Okay, so my memo did
get through to you. Can you give that to Mr. Malander, and then we'll incorporate it?
All right.
Okay.
Thank you. I didn't realize this was given to you.
We touched on it today. It was one of the items listed. So.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other discussion? Members, and would you please watch your emails for our next meeting? We're going to try to decide a date tomorrow of when that meeting will be. So, but we have to balance some things first. With that, meeting is adjourned. Thank you, members.